And then
if you just want to hold that,
it's right in front of your face.
Just like this?
Yep.
And then that's good. And then you can flip it around for me. Perfect. Thank you.
What is that telling you?
It's a color checker. So when I get into post, I just make sure with the program editing with like the blacks or what the black level should be at and all the colors on the chart.
Okay. So you're basically like picking up everything you should be with the lighting and stuff.
Exactly. Okay. Yep. Just making sure that.
Because when you shoot so many different files, you want to make sure white in this is white in that.
Okay.
Because otherwise...
So it's basically a standardization.
Yeah. Exactly. Doing. Yeah.
Okay. Think of like when you go out in winter, the snow can look blue or purple or white or yellow.
Yeah.
Depending on the lighting.
Uh-huh.
Same thing happens to our cameras.
Okay.
We have to tell the camera, this is white.
Okay.
Otherwise it'll go, I think this is white. And then all of a sudden...
Everything just gets... Okay.
Yeah. If you... Back in the day, if you'd watch like local news...
Mm-hmm.
You'd sometimes see some video that came across. It was all just blue or purple or yellow.
Yeah.
And that was because the videographer didn't white balance properly when they got to wherever they were shooting. And then in the days of tape, you couldn't really correct it.
Gotcha. Okay.
And especially, you know, I was one of those young kids back in the day where like, you don't know what you're doing. You're just like, this is what I have. It's 5 minutes to air. It's going on. It's like crap.
We're going to go with it.
That's Wausau News.
Zach, could you just push that top drawer in quick?
I'll get it. It's
you got the mic just...
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Thank you.
I was... That one sticks.
Oh, for sure.
In our old...
It's all in the
probably,
details.
World War II era yeah. desks.
I am ready when you guys are.
I'm good?
Yep.
All right. So you're going to talk to me?
Yep.
I guess let's start by giving us an overview of the various projects you have. Because obviously we had the Zoom call and... I filled up 2 pages of notes while you were talking alone, I think. But kind of give me the 1,000-foot view, and then at some point we'll kind of maybe focus in on a few of those studies.
Okay. And specifically related to walleyes, we have a number of different projects going on right now within the agency and in our fisheries research group here. The one that you were part of yesterday out on Escanaba is a production over harvest experiment. And we've got some evidence that walleye might be being harvested at a rate that's higher than their production or that they can keep up with. And so we're experimentally testing that out here on Escanaba Lake. And that's where you took that footage yesterday. So that's certainly a big one that we're working on right now. We've got a graduate student that's helping us here in the agency, completing his master's degree at University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. What Max is looking at in that project is how fish community productivity is distributed in lakes where walleye natural recruitment has declined over time versus those where it's been sustained in the longer term. And so we really want to try to understand if walleye go down, what might be filling that void, and if whatever is filling that void is then kind of continuing a negative feedback loop to keep suppressing walleye. And so we have some evidence that things like species like black crappie and largemouth bass can be suppressing walleye in some ways. And in Max's project right now, at least preliminarily, that's what we're kind of seeing in that one. We've also got a project related to adding trees to a lake as far as habitat enhancement and that structural habitat that can be beneficial to fish for refuge, for creating foraging opportunities. Some fish like yellow perch lay their egg skeins or ribbons on that wood, and that's important for their reproduction. But that's also a walleye project too, to see how walleye might respond to something like that. But the overall goal of that project, which does include walleye, is by adding this woody habitat to lakes where it's putting in an additional source of carbon to the system, does that increase the entire carrying capacity or fish carrying capacity or productive capacity of lakes? And on that project, 6 years after adding 140 trees to this 100-acre lake, we've doubled the fish community productivity of that system. And so right now that's showing some very positive responses of basically adding woody habitat for a number of reasons for fish, but also it's not just attracting fish, it's producing fish and increasing the carrying capacity of the system. We've had some other desktop exercises, I'll call them, with walleye. We have a lot of data in this state, not only in the fisheries research program, but with our Bureau of Fisheries Management. So we're also looking at things like how are angler effort dynamics for walleyes, are they changing over time in response to some of the challenges that walleye are facing right now. So we've observed some relatively longer term declines in natural recruitment of walleye within the northern part of the state here. And what we found in those studies right now is that it seems like walleye angler effort is kind of responding to that. It's declining correspondingly, which is not necessarily a bad thing because it gives walleye a bit of a break without as much pressure there on those. And we're examining that for all the different sport fishes up here and what if walleye angling effort is going down, what's happening for the other species? And we're seeing anglers respond, I guess, like we think we would. And we're seeing more bass angling, and we're seeing more panfish angling because those species are doing a little bit better right now. So in a nutshell, those are some of the projects that we have going on. There's certainly some other ones too. We do a lot of climate change and climate adaptation work with walleye through our participation in the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. So a lot of work there. We worked with a lot of our federal partners also in the Climate Adaptation Science Centers on different things with walleye, decision support tools, using a framework called Resist, Accept, Direct to try to make decisions about walleyes going forward. And so given the current state of walleyes, where they're doing okay in some places and in some places they're being challenged, we're really throwing a lot at walleye right now, research-wise, to try to understand everything we can about them. Number one, to conserve the species, and number two, to continue to allow harvest opportunities for our tribal members in this area in northern Wisconsin, but then also our recreational anglers.
And some of the studies also, I mean, climate change includes like ice in, ice out, water temp, yep. how that impacts spawning and mm-hmm. recruitment, and whether there's food for them.
Yeah.
I mean, all those kind of go together, right?
Right. And sorry, I failed to mention a really big project that we've been working on for a while, and that's related to climate adaptation and what how walleye are in our cold water and cool water fishes are responding to some of these changes due to climate change. And so you're absolutely right. And right here at the Northern Highland Fishery Research Area, we have 80 years of ice records. And for all the five lakes we're in charge of here. And so what we've seen more recently over the last 10 or 20 years, we see these very wild swings of much shorter ice durations in the wintertime. So ice on is later, ice off is earlier. But what we think is really most influential for some of the changes that we're seeing is the major swings in ice out that's occurring. And so I think it was maybe 2012 and 13 or so, somewhere in there in the early 2010s, where we had like a March 22nd ice out on Escanaba Lake, and the following year it was like mid-May. And so almost 60-day swing in between seasons, which can be really challenging for fish that are used to the norm. So the average ice out for Escanaba Lake here is April 19th over the last 80 years. But like I said, we've swung from basically mid-March to mid-May during that period. And what we've learned in some of those studies is that walleye recruitment, at least in Escanaba Lake, it always seems to be best when it's around the average. And we've studied some of those dynamics, and it seems that walleye, are, their spawning is more linked to photo period than it is to water temperatures, which is a little bit of a newer finding than we would have thought in the past. But as you mentioned, those major swings in the phenology of ice out have some major implications for fish that we're also working on, because as soon as the ice goes out, that starts a succession of everything that might lead to a good recruitment year for walleye. So it starts with the ice going out, and then we get a phytoplankton bloom, or that algae that's in the lake. Then we get a zooplankton bloom that kind of consumes that algae. And at that time, walleye is spawning is going on, those eggs are hatching, and then those young walleye need to have that food resource when it's at its highest abundance to continue to hit all those critical steps just to even get to the first fall of survival. And if we don't have that, then we get really poor year classes or no year class at all. And so I think it's that variability, and not necessarily the directional climate change, that might be most important. It's the variability that we're seeing in it.
So you mentioned this, that walleye is really being focused on. What is it about that species that draws so much attention?
It's a great question, and it's a popular harvest-oriented species. And so for those of us in Wisconsin especially, we enjoy our fish fries, our Friday night fish fries, and oftentimes more than just Friday night. Subsistence fishing in Wisconsin is still a big thing. It's a lot of it. I think from the angler side of things, it's been a popular species for a long time because of it's really good to eat. You know, they're fun to catch. They can reach some large sizes, and it's so some trophy potential there in some cases. And so I think it's that harvest oriented nature and the taste of walleye that really makes them popular with the anglers. The other part of it is that I mentioned, we're the northern third of Wisconsin right now, which constitutes the ceded territories of Wisconsin, where Ojibwe tribal members ceded these lands to the federal government at the time, which would later become Wisconsin in the treaties of 1837 and 1842. And so, part of the Ojibwe culture is that walleye are very culturally important species, very strong subsistence species. I believe one of the species or organisms or beings that led them to settle in this part of the area. And so they're also a very popular fishery for subsistence purposes that are affirmed in the treaty rights that the Ojibwe have in the northern part of the state.
it's fascinating once you start digging into walleye, how many different areas of our economy and our culture and just like the mindset of Wisconsin that there's walleye, people care about walleye everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, when you interact with a lot of anglers, I mean, that's who's going to come through here and pull out a Creel survey. And
right.
Is whether they're, I mean, I'm sure there's bass fishermen, there's trout fishermen, and then there's fishermen. And mm-hmm. like fishermen, it's almost like walleye is inserted in there as automatic. Whether they're going for it or not, they would love to catch a walleye.
Sure.
Yeah. And is that just the way it is, or that's the way it's always been?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I would say maybe a little bit more so in the past. Like walleye were always one of those species, I think, and this might lead to just more of the subsistence thing or, you know, a really good fish to eat, right? So if I think back to being a kid or going fishing with my father or even my grandfather, walleye was always the king. That was the thing that you were after. That's why they were taking a trip from Milwaukee up to Eagle River or up to northern Minnesota. It was to catch walleye. It wasn't to catch smallmouth bass. It wasn't to catch muskie. It was they wanted walleye because walleye were good to eat. And like I said, it was a big part of, you know, livelihood at that point. And so I think there's some generational stuff that passes on there and it really continues. I think now what we have is a little bit more specialization in some anglers. We certainly have anglers that are very happy to go out and just enjoy a good day on the water. They don't really care if they catch anything or not, but it's very therapeutic and relaxing to cast a line. And, oh, I got a nice bass today, and it was the greatest day of my life. But we also see a lot more specialization in anglers now where it might be, I am a walleye angler. And so every bit of my boat, gear, technology, baits is all geared towards walleye. And if the fishing isn't good for walleye here, I'm going to drive some distances to get where I need to. And it goes from there. Specialized trout anglers, specialized bass anglers, specialized muskie anglers. And so they're certainly generalist, but we still have, you know, plenty of specialized walleye anglers. And like, especially like you said, you know, it's a very harvest oriented fish. There's not many that are legally caught. If you're still under your bag limit, they're probably not going to go home and get filleted and eaten.
Mm-hmm. So you grew up in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. I grew up in Stevens Point.
Okay. So for you, walleye fishing was part of childhood, right?
It was, yeah.
I mean, do you remember your first walleye? Is there a picture of it somewhere?
Oh, boy. Oh. I remember some really early ones, not trying for them. So, you know, the Wisconsin River was basically my playground as a child, and very good walleye fishery still is in the Stevens Point area, still is throughout the entire river. I remember pre-fishing for a bass tournament. My dad was a bass tournament fisherman in the 1980s, and we were on the, the Winnebago. We were in Poygan. We were kind of in that chain there. It was a Wolf River tournament, and we were fishing on Poygan, and I caught a really big walleye on a spinnerbait fishing for a bass. I remember that one very vividly. But I also think, remember mostly as a kid, when the walleyes were running during the spawn, we'd all be just down on the banks with our Y-sticks and have a minnow, you know, plunked out there in the river. And there were some nights that we'd run out of bait. We'd catch so many walleyes. But at that time, they were all about 14 and a half, 14 and three quarter inches, because the harvest pressure was pretty high. We've changed the regulations now. But I would say those are some of the earliest memories. Also coming up to northern Wisconsin. So even though I'm here now and living and working and, you know, raising children in the area right now, we came up here in the summer. We came up here in the spring and in the fall. And oftentimes we were specifically targeting walleyes up here. So
there's a lot of people that associate walleye with northern Wisconsin and with lakes, mm-hmm. even though walleye are a river fish, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so explain to me, when did walleye move from rivers to lakes? Was that man-made, or is it just because rivers came into flowages, or how did that happen where it became this northern Wisconsin delicacy?
So another really great question, and people have asked that question before, and I often think about it this way. So if we think about Back to the Future, if I had a time machine, I'd love to go back and sample the lakes right after the glacier receded here and just see what the landscape looked like and see what the fish communities look like. My inclination is that during the glaciation, the refuge for walleye would have been, the Chippewa River, Wisconsin River, Mississippi River, probably Lake Superior. Now that glacier recedes, and then we don't know exactly how that water's moving across the landscape. My guess is that walleyes were native to some of our drainage lakes here, some that were connected to rivers where they had access to them. Although we don't know, again, how that water moved across the landscape. We have proposed, and we haven't received funding yet. There's ways to check on this through like environmental DNA, where you could take the core of a lake bed and look for scales or other DNA in there to find out, let's go back 500 years before you know, humans really started distributing walleye around the landscape. Were there walleye here? Was there evidence for walleye here at that point? But to your point, like, you know, I would say mostly, I would say probably the rivers for sure, where they exist today, the drainage lakes where they might have had a connection to some river and then were able to persist. But the other, to the other point with your question there, or your comment, is that man has distributed walleyes in a lot of places. And so walleyes have been stocked for a really long time. Escanaba Lake outside our window here, that was stocked in the 50s and eventually became a naturally reproducing population and one of the better ones we have up here. But if we think about that, walleye were moved all over the landscape. In some places they stuck and were able to naturally reproduce and sustain themselves. In other places they need to be maintained by stocking if we're going to have them there. So it's one of the things that we think about often with the challenges in walleye recruitment declines is, you know, if walleye weren't supposed to be there in the first place, is Mother Nature kind of kicking back now from a habitat perspective or other things that says, yeah, maybe they pulled off a couple natural recruiting year classes and now that habitat is giving the, that lake is giving you what it should be giving you, maybe bass and bluegills and crappies. And to your other point, and it's one that, you know, we really try to communicate out to anglers and members of the public and stuff like that, is a lot of our, you know, stakeholders and the people we interact with, they think that walleye are a lake fish. Walleye are naturally a river fish. They're adapted to rivers. And so if we look at some of the absolute best walleye populations, they're always associated with rivers. Canadian Shield Lakes, they all have inflows, outflows. Where do the walleye spawn? They run up the river. Wisconsin River, they'll usually run up to the next dam. But they've adapted to lakes in some cases where there's similar riverine habitat, but where there's not, often that's where they need to be maintained almost solely by stocking, or we have some challenges, you know, for them persisting.
You hit on this, but I want to kind of elaborate on this idea that maybe some of the decline in walleye populations in some of these places is what where they're supposed to be at. Like they were, and I draw the comparison to like deer population in the 90s when they were at the all-time peak high and everyone just assumed, well, that's just as many deer as I have a right to see every week. And then population goes down, maybe back to a norm, and then people are like, well, where did all the deer go?
Yeah.
Is there a similar mindset of walleye of like, well, what I remember catching three walleye in a night as a kid should be my, that I should be able to do that every time.
There definitely is. And so when we talk to members of the public or just being in town here, it's a small town and it might be a church and someone's like, I used to be able to catch walleyes, get my limit of walleyes every single day and this lake's no good anymore. And things like that. So there's definitely legacy effects of that. And similar like with your analogy with deer right there, I would say, you know, when Bill Clinton was president, walleyes were doing really good in Wisconsin. And then we've started to kind of taper down for various reasons right now. So the legacy effects are challenging because, you know, everybody generally wants things to be the way they used to be or better, right? Just like your deer example. And right now there's been some challenges with that over time. So, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
I mean, is it possible to put percentages, or perhaps what you're trying to find, of like when you look at the cause of decline of walleye populations in some of these lakes that historically used to be good, how much of it is natural, how much of it is climate oriented, mm-hmm. how much of it is harvest pressure?
Yeah. So what we know, or at least we have evidence for right now, is it's a combination of a number of things, and then, you know, when you have those sorts of additive effects, it creates greater challenges. So there could be certainly situations where walleye were stocked into a lake, conditions were more favorable at that time, they reproduced a little bit, and then they went away over time. But that went away over time could also, you know, be related to things like habitat loss within the system. And so we've lost some critical spawning habitat, or the lakeshore residential development got really, really high and intensive on the lake, and it took away some of the things that walleye need. Because that's where I always like to start. You know, we can't expect fish or any organism to sustain itself if it doesn't have appropriate habitat. And so I think we certainly have some challenges, and there's been some challenges on walleyes there too, where climate change would certainly come into a play on some of that habitat, because habitat just isn't rocks in a lake or a tree in a lake. It's also, it's everything a fish needs to complete its life cycle, basically. So that can include water temperatures, that can include the prey fish it needs, the resources at the right time of year. So, you know, habitat definitely a factor in walleye population declines. abundances in alternative species. Like I mentioned, largemouth bass and crappie, we have some pretty strong evidence that when their abundances, those species abundances are high, we generally always see poor natural recruitment. Bullheads, overabundant bullheads could also be in that category. We also have things just like different, we were talking about specialized anglers. We have different angler dynamics. And there's some species that are very harvest oriented, like walleye, and there's other species that over time have become almost exclusive catch and release. So if we're catching and release all of our bass and we're catching and release all of our muskies, there's a delicate balance in all these lakes that if we don't take that ecosystem or food web context with it, we can also run into some challenges there. And we've certainly seen that for walleye as well. And so those are some of the factors that have kind of popped out over time as, you know, negatively influencing walleye populations or potentially suppressing them. Because, you know, previously when you're talking about, like, let's just say the golden years, the really good times before we hit some of these challenges right now, is that, you know, walleye were in lakes and they were cultivating conditions to benefit themselves. Now, through some of these changes, those cultivating conditions to benefit themselves and their own fitness have kind of gone away, and that's what's suppressing them and also suppressing them from recovery, even through some of our management efforts.
I mean, I'm sure you remember coming up here as a kid, there weren't nearly as many houses on all the lakes. They weren't nearly as developed. They weren't mowing down to the water line. Like, they weren't clearing all the trees and they weren't cutting all the weeds in the water. They weren't using the big power boats that were like ripping up the bottom of the lake. I mean, how much do all those factors that people think, well, that's how I enjoy my vacation, that's how I enjoy my time up north, impact the other element of that, which is the fish that live in a lake?
Yeah, I mean, I remember it very well. You know, coming up here as a kid, it might be more of a two-bedroom cabin, so to speak. It might have still had an outhouse. You know, it was just, the footprint was a lot less than what we're seeing on the landscape now on the shore, and even within the lakes themselves with all the docks and shore stations and things like that. So, you know, what I'd definitely say, and we have a little bit of evidence for this that could be challenging walleye recruitment in some ways through a project that's ended now, but it was a comparative walleye recruitment project on 60 lakes in northern Wisconsin, that there is a signal in lakeshore residential development. And I think what's just happened is just it intensified, and that footprint has gotten so much bigger over time, and that's had, you know, potentially some challenges to within lake habitat in that regard. And so again, you know, with that, what we're trying to do is, you know, do outreach, conduct the experiments to try to find a balance, right? How much riparian buffer, how much do we leave natural in 100 feet of frontage or 200 feet of frontage to kind of give fish and wildlife that clean water, that good habitat, the things that they need in order to persist and sustain themselves. So having that balance, right? Everybody enjoys water in a different way, but working together to try to get a balance so it's best for everything, for clean water, for fish, for wildlife.
So I remember as a kid that it used to be you would look, we would come up north when we would get the little guides that showed all the homes for sale. And it would be like, fishing lake, fishing lake, mm-hmm. fishing lake, great walleye lake. I went around town yesterday and tried to find, first, they don't print them because of the internet.
Yeah.
But even when you do find something, like, I had an agent check for me. There's zero listings in Vilas and Oneida counties right now that say walleye in them. There's walleye circle out of town, but otherwise there's zero listings for anything advertising itself as a good walleye lake.
Yeah. So I think there's been some changes there too, right? Of, you know, if we think about when northern Wisconsin was kind of opened up by the railways, and it's a resort-based economy, just like my grandparents and my father, they were coming up here a couple times a summer. That was their big vacation of the year, and it was to go to a resort, and it was primarily to go fishing. Now there's a lot more diverse experiences in northern Wisconsin, and they may not all be related to fishing. We have very few resorts left compared to what used to be on many of the lakes up here. That was a big industry, or that was a big economic boost to this area for those folks that own resorts. And so it's not a resort-based economy anymore. It's still a tourist-based economy, and fishing is certainly a part of that, but it's also been very diversified. And so we have hundreds or however many miles of paved bike trails up here now. We have, you know, excellent camping and state forest camping in this area. We have all kinds of other amenities, silent sports, right? So canoeing, kayaking, paddleboarding, lots of different things to do up here, and fishing is just a component of that, but I don't think it's the biggest component of it anymore like it used to be. And so that's one thing that's certainly changed over time.
And so that makes it less likely that fishing or walleye can drive the efforts of like what should the area focus on. Like, you're not going to convince the area to say, well, we're not going to develop that lake. Let's leave that lot empty.
It very well could be, because like I said, there's so many diverse uses of lakes anymore. It's not just we're going up for a week to go to a cabin and go fishing all day long. And so that certainly could be reasons why it's not being publicized. I mean, it still is in some cases. We're in Boulder Junction here. We're in the muskie capital of the world. That's still a big part of the community and draws anglers for that species from all over the world, really, because it is a trophy species in this area, well known for it. And so maybe it's not advertised as fishing lakes or anything like that, but you know, the fishing is still outstanding here. It's just that there's been a diversification of experiences and people all enjoy all kinds of different things.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at the state's involvement in walleye, and obviously Governor Walker had his walleye initiative, $10 million, and you know, there've been obviously the DNR is funding studies in this area. What's driving that? What is the impetus behind that? The focus that did take place and is taking place on walleye.
I think it's all the things we've really talked about, right? So it's an incredibly popular recreational fishery, and I believe still number one in Wisconsin. That's the most popular fish that's sought for. Like I said, you also have the tribal subsistence fishery up here. And so really there's so much focus on that because of the popularity recreationally, the economic impact of walleye, which still is significant in northern Wisconsin, and then ensuring that harvest opportunities are available for our Ojibwe tribal members that have affirmed those rights. And so I think that really sets the stage there for a tremendous amount of research, dedicated funding, the stocking and the Wisconsin Walleye Initiative to try to conserve this species and continue to provide those harvest opportunities. You know, from a agency perspective or for my research team perspective with DNR, you know, our number one job is to conduct research to conserve walleye. So as resource professionals, that's our number one job. Two, if we can do that, then we can provide harvest opportunities. And so as an agency, we've been focused in a lot of ways. Research, stocking, we've changed some regulations around to decrease exploitation rates and to decrease effort out there, yet still allow for harvest opportunity. And I think we're continuing to try to find ways to basically dial it back on walleyes where we need to and be responsive of those natural recruitment declines and those production declines. Because just like the experiment that's going on this window, if we keep collectively harvesting walleyes more than they're capable of replacing themselves, they're going to go down. There's no other way to figure it out. And we've been in situations, I think recently and in some cases and in some lakes, where we continue to harvest the same slice of pie out of an ever shrinking pie. And that's basically what's happening in some places. And so we have to dial it back and in many ways need to be thinking about additional ways to reduce exploitation rates or harvest rates on walleye because of the challenging climate conditions, because of the other stressors that they're facing, because that's one variable that we can control among a bunch that we can't in the short term. We can dial back harvest and exploitation in hopes that we can find other ways to manage, or there's other things that we can do to sustain walleye into the future.
So obviously you have the research element, and a lot of what you're focusing on is the lakes themselves and finding ways to, you know, help natural recruitment. Then there's the stocking programs mm-hmm. that exist, and there's like the Walleyes for Tomorrow right. and their efforts, and then there's the tribal efforts and you know, other programs out there designed to, you know, reintroduce walleye. Do you view that as complementary, or is it not that it's one or the other, but can you stock enough if you're not doing the conservation elements that are necessary to make sure that the habitat is quality?
Yeah, you know, from my perspective and the things that we've done research, really habitat is number one. As I mentioned earlier, if we can't conserve or sustain or enhance habitat that a fish species like walleye needs, you know, they're not going to be able to sustain themselves in the longer term. They have to have that all that critical habitat in order to do that. So some of the things we've written about and talked about is that, you know, stocking gets a lot of press. It's very popular There's a lot of anglers, and people think that that's where fish come from. The stocking truck pulls up and now I have fish in the lake. That's not where how it works. Ideally, we want natural recruiting populations that are self-sustaining, and we put some regulations, we manage to keep that going. And so some of the things that we talked about is that, you know, if you're considering stocking, we should be at least equally considering habitat considerations, or even more, because if we consider habitat, that's the longer term solution. Stocking might be the shorter term solution. And stocking doesn't always work. And you know, it doesn't work in a lot of cases, actually. We did a whole experiment with the Wisconsin Walleye Initiative to look at a gradient of lake productivities and lake sizes, different stocking densities. So what's like the optimal stocking rate, right? In general, you know, they weren't very good overall. So we have an optimal stocking rate and this and for this type of lake, but we're still seeing, you know, 90% or better mortality between when those fish are stocked out to the following year. And so that's not very high. And it's really difficult. We can never really engineer at this point what Mother Nature can do in natural recruitment. So we can stock all that we want, but in general, we're going to have a walleye fishery at best that's going to be 1.5 to 2 adult walleye per acre, whereas a natural recruiting population in good situations is going to be above 3 and sometimes well above 3 adults per acre.
And where what number would it be a good baseline to use for what people would consider a good walleye lake?
So basically in our walleye management plan, we're trying to maintain walleye populations at 3 adults per acre or more. That's where kind of the benchmark is, particularly in the ceded territory of Wisconsin. When we work with our Ojibwe tribal members and the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, that's one of the things that we're evaluating. Are we sustaining walleye populations above this level? Because, you know, looking at the data, that's what provides what we'll call a fishable population for anglers, where catch rates and harvest rates might be satisfactory. It also provides harvest opportunity for our tribal members and gives us a little buffer of resilience there too, where we're not down at like 1 per acre or 1/2 of adult per acre, because now we might start challenging recruitment in that way too. So the other portion of that, you know, 3 adults per acre above is to see multiple year classes, which suggests that there's natural recruitment going on. So those are the sorts of metrics that we look at and the goals and benchmarks we try to maintain, particularly for our natural reproducing walleye populations.
Tie the stocking argument and the lack of, you know, how the mortality rates in stocking back to your conversation about how habitat restoration is not just for walleye, it's for all the things that are part of the walleye ecosystem.
Right.
Because if you don't have all of that understory and habitat for everything they need to eat or hide, you know, all those chains, then they won't exist.
So tie that back,
yeah, kind of the stocking. Link how, if you don't do the habitat to create all the things they need to eat from the time they're a fry to the time they're an adult, it doesn't matter whether you dump how many eggs and you take out and dump back as fry or as fingerlings, they're not going to make it to adult size.
Right. And so, you know, with stocking, what we've kind of done with walleyes over time is let's raise them longer. Let's raise them into the first fall. Let's get them to 6, 8, 9 inches. And so we've got them past all those bottlenecks that might occur naturally. But there's also challenges there that occur in the hatchery. We're rearing them at high densities. They, you know, are being fed kind of ad libitum with food, and they haven't had to hide from predators or go out and chase down food, so to speak, in a natural environment. And so the stocking's kind of circumvented that. But when we go to the habitat part of things and trying to get everything right, again, it's looking at situations of creating those cultivating conditions for walleye. So where does it start? It starts with, you know, what does our spawning habitat for walleye look like? Do we have maybe a good windswept shoreline that gets, you know, washed of detritus and silt? So we've got some good gravel, cobble, and some rock. That's where, you know, that's a place to start. Now we've got, let's say we got a good enough adult population. We've got good spawning habitat. They lay those eggs there. Those eggs hatch. Now moving to the other parts of habitat, if we've got a lot of fertilizer going into the lake and we get like really eutrophic conditions and we start to see algal blooms and stuff like that, that may not be good habitat for walleye for that next stage. Likewise, you know, with the zooplankton and carrying on from there, zooplankton, are the conditions good so that those youngier walleye, once they feed off their the remaining portion of their yolk sac and they need to go eat that zooplankton, is it available? Is it abundant so that they can grow to hit that next level and change over to eating fish? part of habitat, what's our perch population? What's our forage fish population? Perch, yellow perch, are a big prey item for walleye. And so when those walleye are this big and they start to switch to eating fish prey, often perch and walleye are peanut butter and jelly species. They go together. But we have to be doing things for perch habitat too, if that's one of the big things, or making sure there's plenty of minnows or other forage, because, you know, like I said, it takes, you know, I don't know how many steps, but there's a lot. There's so many steps throughout the course of that first summer that a young walleye has to get past that hurdle, get big enough, get enough energy just to make it to that first fall so that they have enough energy to make it through the next rough winter as a small fish out there. Likewise, not to get eaten. That might be structural habitat. That might be taking care of and making sure we've got native aquatic plant beds for young walleye to hide in. And it goes even farther with like thermal and optical habitat with walleye. So, you know, I hope, you know, that's a lot, but in a nutshell, it's very, very complex. And all these things have to come together in order for any fish species to have fitness and propagate itself.
Mm-hmm. So you were here for the walleye initiative?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What? Remember the headlines. What did it actually do? What where did that money go, and what was it supposed to do?
So the Wisconsin Walleye Initiative was basically Governor Walker's effort to kind of go, not necessarily go all in on stocking with a different sort of product. So in the past, Wisconsin would have raised basically fry, small fingerlings, and then a few what we call extended growth or large fingerlings. And so our fry stockings would occur pretty soon, actually, you know, probably late May, early June. So those female brood stock, they're stripped, the eggs are fertilized with milt, they're in the hatchery batteries, and then where they're pretty tiny, we're stocking out millions and millions and millions of fry into systems. So that was one of the things that we did a lot of in the past. The other one that we did a lot was like the small fingerlings that would get stocked out like midsummer. Now we're talking walleye that are probably an inch or two long. So we've taken them past a couple of other critical bottlenecks in the hatchery, and we're going to put them in the system. We won't stock as many of them as the small fry, but we're still stocking a lot of them. You know, with the Wisconsin Walleye Initiative, that funding was specifically to bump up hatchery infrastructure, not only within DNR to create more ponds, but then it also helped our tribal partners with their hatcheries and also some private hatcheries too, to raise walleyes to meet the demand of what we thought we needed in Wisconsin. And at that time, it was thought that by raising walleyes into their first fall and getting them to, like I said, 6, 8, 9 inches in the hatchery before stocking them out, that we'd have passed any potential bottleneck that would occur in the lake naturally, and that they'd have higher survival. And there's a pretty good amount of literature out there, scientific literature now, that suggests that that's not always the case. So there's still challenges, I mentioned previously, with those young year walleye. Even though they're much larger, there's things like more transport stress. There's things like adapting to a new wild environment versus the hatchery. And we've also seen some other challenges too with like sex ratios through that rearing process, where we seem to be producing more female walleye than male walleye throughout that longer rearing process, which is not necessarily obviously good for natural recruitment or restoring natural recruitment, because you need males and females to do that, not just females.
Mm-hmm. So is that program basically done, or are the impacts of that still being felt in any way?
No, the program's certainly still going on. And our two main walleye hatcheries in the state, Governor Thompson over in Spooner and Art Emke over in this area in Woodruff, are still producing extended growth fingerling walleyes. Same thing with our tribal partners and some private entities. So we're still, that's the primary product that's being stocked out there. I think what we've learned, or what we've changed over the past 10 years, is that the initiative itself was designed as a deliberate experiment to learn from it. Optimal stocking rates, what lakes are best, where do we see the greatest survivorship of the stocked product. And so now that we have, you know, 10 years of data and we've analyzed all that, we've started to pull some lakes off the list because they're not good candidates for this limited and actually expensive product to create.
And what's the reaction from the locals when you say, well, your lake's just not worth doing this in?
It's challenging. And so it's always challenging to have those conversations, especially when there's a lot of legacy effects about how this has always been a walleye lake and DNR has always stocked it. But like I said, propagation isn't getting any cheaper. The cost of feed is expensive. The infrastructure is expensive. And so we only have a limited number of walleyes that we can produce. And the goal for Wisconsin DNR and the agency is that our number one goal is to be stocking to rehabilitate natural recruitment, or the natural recruitment of a previously naturally recruiting population. Our goal is to not, you know, we're not interested in stocking that limited product in a lake that is not going to support walleye or shows no evidence that stocking is going to contribute to rehabilitating natural recruitment. So they're difficult conversations, but the the public and lake associations and stakeholder groups, they have options where they can apply for permits, they can go through private growers and get fish or walleye to stock their lakes. They just need to be of the right genetic strain, because there's unique genetic strains that are basically or roughly corresponding to the watershed boundaries of Wisconsin. So right now we're in the upper Wisconsin River watershed. So if I was a lakeshore resident or on a lake association, I wanted to stock my lake and the DNR was not going to stock it for various reasons, I would have to ensure that it was a Wisconsin, upper Wisconsin River genetic strain coming from a private grower.
Mm-hmm. And there's the Winnebago, there's Green Bay, there's Chippewa, and then what else is there?
So you've got like your upper Wisconsin, your upper Chippewa. Those are the two big northern Wisconsin drainages. You've got Lake Michigan drainage, which would include Fox River. Okay. And things like that. And then you got things like the Rock River down in southern Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when it comes to the politics surrounding all this, of like how much money goes into studies and which studies get advanced, and you know, even going back to the Walleye Initiative, is it bipartisan? I mean, is it everyone wants to see this happen, or is it the how do all the politics play into this? And I'm not asking you to get into the partisan politics, but just the idea that it's not just science and anglers and that stuff on the water. There's a whole background of where the money comes from and where the priorities go.
And I think politically, obviously, walleye are very important, for a number of reasons. I think it's economically, most certainly, because it's still a very economically valuable fishery for the recreational anglers. It's still Wisconsin's most popular fish to fish for. We have, a responsibility to our Ojibwe tribal members and partners in the northern third of the state to make sure or try to ensure that harvest opportunities are still there. As far as funding and from a research perspective and a research team, my group and I and our collaborators, we're objective scientists. We don't get into the politics of the situation. We're fortunate to have funding to work on some of these things, to try to figure out ways to conserve walleyes, to manage them, to continue to provide those harvest opportunities. We hope and we conduct science that could be used to inform science-based decision-making, and it is in a lot of cases. But when the political stuff happens, that's really outside the arena of science. And so, being fortunate to lead my group of researchers, the Office of Applied Science with DNR, that's something that we talk about all the time, is that we shouldn't feel bad if our science isn't used. Our job is to provide the objective science, to make it available. And if it informs decisions, that's great. If something happens politically or otherwise that disallows that, that's no skin off our back. We're going to continue to do our jobs as professionals and objective scientists to provide that information if it's needed.
So there is a line between the research and the science versus the advocacy.
Absolutely. And again, something that we stress greatly within my team and talk about often is that there's no place for advocacy for us as scientists and professionals. We conduct objective, unbiased science that's not hoping for something, it's not wishing for something, there's not an agenda behind it or something that we like personally desire or value that's going to come out in that research. It's terse, it's concise. We're scientists, that's the way we're trained, and that's what keeps us away from that advocacy. I kind of crack a joke to myself, advocacy for a scientist can happen when they're retired or they're no longer doing science, but when we're doing science and in the way that we're trained in the profession, it is absolutely critical to remain objective. Otherwise, there is no credibility to science.
But that's got to be frustrating at some point. Like you've done all these research studies, you know the impacts, and you go to a local zoning committee meeting, and like what they're proposing to do is like going to destroy what they say they value. And do you get called into those? Are you asked to ever offer your professional scientific opinion of like, hey, we're going to cite this 5,000 head, the pig operation that was going to come up here, the dairy CAFO or something, or we're going to flatten out this area and fill in this wetland, and we're going to build some condos on this lake because they're really valuable.
Yeah, we get called in these situations all the time. I have been in a number of cases, whether it's with lake habitat. It could be, you know, position statements on some sort of negotiation that's going on that's related to fish or some sort of policy decision. And again, the only thing that we can, that I feel comfortable providing is the science. This is the science behind it. And this would be my recommendation. Whether that's used or not at the end of the day is not up to me. And so, you know, I think for my team of scientists, biologists, and technicians, we never get upset if those sorts of things happen. I think, you know, it's nice, I guess, or it's rewarding when you see the science that we're doing is used to inform policy, and then, you know, that policy is making a difference or improving something or conserving something. But, you know, in those position sorts of meetings, or if you're called into those sorts of things, we do our best to present the science. If it's complex science, we make sure that that's understandable or in easily understandable ways to everybody that's there in the audience. We take the time to have individual conversations and talk to folks about what we've learned, maybe what our recommendations might be. The other thing that I'll add here too is that often in those sorts of cases, I'll call it demonstration science, where we'll actually do some science to demonstrate directly that's very relevant to publics or lake associations or stakeholder group why this is not a good thing. And I'll go to a couple examples here, and one that we're going to see this afternoon. So for my PhD, we were afraid that Lakeshore residential development was pulling all the coarse woody habitat out of lakes. We had a strong relationship there. So for my PhD work, I basically did a demonstration experiment. I think anglers knew that wood is a good place to fish around, it's providing these sorts of benefits. But unless somebody shows me what actually happens, then we're not going to worry about it as Lakeshore residents. We pulled 75% of the wood out of a lake. Well, what happened? We lost the perch population, bass growth rates went down, and there were other ecosystem changes. So we did the experiment to show this is how important this habitat is, so let's conserve it on the landscape and potentially add in more. Likewise, the experiment, the tree drop experiment we're doing right now to see if it increases fish production. The lakes in northern Wisconsin, for the most part, all the energy in them is coming off the landscape. It's leaves that fall in the water in the fall. It's dissolved organic carbon that's leaching from wetland plants naturally that go into the system. It's trees that fall into lakes and slowly degrade. So if you start pulling all those things away or changing the watershed or the riparian zone of the lake, you're decreasing that lake's ability to support fish and other organisms. And so this is another demonstration experiment where we put it back in or we conserve that process, we maintain fish production or actually increase it. So that's another thing we've tried to use with groups like that when we get in those situations of what's your best professional judgment? What does the science say behind this? Sometimes we'll do experiments to show, we'll go out and manipulate it. Here's a simulation where we manipulate what we think is going on. It might not be a best thing. What happens?
It's got to make you feel good, though, if like you can actually show, like, here's what the science shows, and then people's eyes, like you could see their eyes open up and light up as they go, yeah. Oh, wow, I never knew that.
They do. It's really interesting. Like, you can talk and talk and talk, but all of a sudden, like, you have that experiment or you have that one key thing that really triggers somebody. It's like, oh, now I get it. And what we've been doing maybe is not the best for clean water or maybe not the best for these fish populations. And so we're going to turn that around. And it can oftentimes, you know, once those demonstration experiments or, you know, you have those conversations, then it can become contagious really quick within lake associations and with the public too. And that's, you know, really some of the only ways you can sort of break those social norms of particular activities and try to get that balance of, you know, what everybody enjoys, the diverse amount of things that people enjoy associated with water and lakes, and then the balance for, like I said, water quality for fish wildlife populations.
So one other thing that I want, you've referenced the ceded territory and the treaty rights. Yeah. How often do you have to try and break through those myths about walleye population? And it's all the tribes. It's all the Indians are spearing all the fish out of these. I remember that as a kid coming up north. You know, we obviously saw the walleye wars and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, is that still persistent in some pockets up here?
It's still persistent in some pockets up here. I think there's been a tremendous amount of progress made on that front through outreach efforts. I still think there's more that could be done. You know, being here at Escanaba Lake as part of the Northern Han Fisher Research Area, we interact with 3,000 to 5,000 anglers per year. We talk to a lot of folks. You know, we're right here within the ceded territory. We also hear a lot of things. Also being embedded in small communities, people know what we do and who we are, who we work for, and so you hear things sometimes that way too. And so what we've really tried to do, you know, as an agency, and I still think we can potentially do even more, is to make sure that we're, you know, having those conversations with people when those sorts of things come up. You know, we'll still hear things like, you know, the tribal members spear all the big walleyes. Not true. 85% of tribal harvest is male. And there's also regulations on the number of larger walleye that can be taken by tribal members, and those are primarily the females. There's not a lot of male walleyes that reach past 20 inches in the ceded territory. So we hear, you know, about those sorts of things. I might hear that I can't catch a walleye anymore because the tribal members have speared out my lake so hard. You know, the anglers are harvesting fish too. And there's more equity between the anglers and the tribal members through some changes that have been made now. But we just have to have those conversations and get the facts out there. So we certainly do that here. As an agency, we try to do that out in our interactions with the public and try not to be shy about, again, letting people know really how the system operates. Why did I have to get creel surveyed as an angler today? The tribal members don't have to go through that. Yes, they absolutely do. Every single walleye that's harvested in the tribal spring fishery comes through a compulsory creel and monitored. And so, again, we need to keep having this outreach, having this discourse with people and making sure that the facts are getting out there. Because at the end of the day, it's a well-managed system. It's a heavily managed system for both fisheries. It's closely monitored. And, you know, for lack of a better term, a harvested walleye is a harvested walleye, and it doesn't really matter what method it's harvested by, whether it's hook and line or whether it's by a spear. That's how the management system works. It's a joint fishery. It's going to be a joint fishery forever, hopefully, as long as we continue to provide these harvest opportunities. And so we just need to get past it and accept that these are Ojibwe rights that were ceded in those treaties. It's a joint fishery. Everyone's got an opportunity, which is fantastic. Because it could be the other way around too. There might not be. There could be a case where we don't have any opportunity at all. And so we work together, get the facts out there, and continue to try to educate people on the situation.
And from what I understand, I know the Red Cliff harvest eggs, and they stock. Mm-hmm. I believe Mole Lake does. Do yep. most of the tribes stock, or is it just a few of them do?
So Red Cliff does, for sure. I think Bad River has the capabilities, but I'm not sure if they've been raising fish recently. Mole Lake does for sure, Lac de Flambeau, and then I'm not sure if St. Croix is raising many fish right now, but that's, yeah, so.
But people probably don't think of like the fact that they actually put fish back in.
Yeah, they do. So several of the tribes, or maybe the majority of them, in the ceded territory of Wisconsin here are raising fish, yeah.
Is anyone else here? There are a couple guys that pulled up. I don't know if you need to go take care of them.
Can I take a break?
Yeah, we'll unplug you quick.
I won't hook this.